Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about the playtest of our most recent dungeon design dash at Rising Phoenix Game Con, just 48 hours after we made it live on this channel. We're going to cover what worked, what didn't, and what the players did that nobody expected. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we dive into today's topic, I will remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our private Discord channel that is available to all of our patrons. So you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get that all settled before the end of the show, and about maybe 10 minutes after the show, we will be there to chat with you all more about dungeon design dashes and whatever else hits our minds.
We love it every week, and we just have the best patrons, and thanks to our patron Bacrius for checking in. We are currently live on Twitch, YouTube, and Restream. Thanks so much for that. So that was so it's been a couple weeks now, Paul, but you know, I'm personally really grateful to the people who run Rising Phoenix Game Con. That was a great time for us. They were very hospitable for the very unusual thing that we were doing.
Yeah, it's a great group. It's a great convention, and I highly recommend it. So anybody looking for a good time gaming in mid-April or late April in Massachusetts, you should definitely add it to your list. It's a great convention. I think when I pitched this to them, I think maybe it was a little unclear what the heck I was talking about. But they were absolutely game. And I think afterwards there was a lot of thoughts from them about like how we could make it even more successful next year. So it's, you know, really great.
And I think on our end as well, I mean, we went in, this is the first time we've done it like live in person, one of our dungeon design dashes. Again, for people that are new to the channel here, we designed an entire D&D old school adventure in 1 hour live, is what we try to do. With viewer help. So this was the first time we ever did it actually in person with other warm bodies in the room. And it was an experiment for us going in. And I think we are also going to learn how to make that more viable, more streamlined. And if we had to make some mistakes, that's how we were going to learn.
No, Dan, I think we've acknowledged at this point that 90 minutes is probably the sweet spot for this. That an hour is a little tight. You know, when we try to target, we dig up a map that is about a dozen or so rooms, give or take, which fits the format well. And you know, we could probably cut it down to an hour by making it an even smaller dungeon, but I think that would be less satisfying, right?
Let's talk about that, Paul. So that's actually one of the points I want to talk about, because I feel that between you and me, like at this point, I feel like I've heard at least three different brains between the two of us about what the optimal size is between like us trying to design it in 90 minutes and also hopefully, you know, we would like it to be useful probably in a one shot, like maybe a, you know, 4 hour session at a convention, I think is what the use case is. And so I have usually pitched like 12 in meaty encounter areas as a good spot. You just said here that we might be able to tighten up the design process to a small. But when we came out from RPGCon, I remember you saying that you wish that you had more rooms.
For sure.
In the adventure. Why is that?
I said we could make it less than 12 rooms if we wanted to constrain the whole show down to an hour. If we wanted to accomplish the whole thing in an hour, but I don't think that's a good idea, and I would not advise it. Okay. I would rather give ourselves more time to do more rooms than to try and cut down the amount of content. 12 rooms I think is a little light, honestly. Usually when I'm running And that's what we saw, right? So we yep. ran this, we ran the Dungeon Design Dash on Friday afternoon, then proceeded to do stuff throughout the convention. And Sunday morning, I ran a session of the very dungeon we had designed for, I don't know how many players did I have, Dan, maybe six or seven, I want to say, something in that realm.
Six-ish.
I think it was listed for up to eight players, and I don't think I had quite the full table. I would say in under 4 hours, they had completed the majority of the content. Right. And we hit a spot with like still a good hour and a half left, where I said like, great, well, we've kind of resolved the major elements yes. of the adventure. There are some more rooms you haven't explored. You could continue moving about the area and exploring those rooms if you want, which they did. And so we did a little bit more of that. Ultimately, by the end, they had explored all but one or all but two of the rooms, I think.
Right? Yeah, right. Agreed.
They had missed one cave, which happened to contain a secret door into a secret treasure room. So they missed that. I can't imagine that would have been if we had decided like, no, absolutely must be thorough and explore every nook and cranny. We probably could have fit that in, frankly. I think they could have probably fit that in and still been within the 4 hours. And I don't like that from convention play. I generally, when I'm running a dungeon crawl at a convention, I want there to be more content than the group can possibly experience. I find that makes a more satisfying run of the game. You never hit that point where you're just like scrubbing out. Like there's this emotional impact, I think, of like, we've done all the interesting stuff, and now we're just for completeness, you know, getting those last little crumbs of adventure. And I don't like that. I would rather end on a bang, right? I'd rather end, we're rushing towards an exciting conclusion, and we get that done, and we say, okay, that's the end. You saw as much as you're going to see.
That's good for me to hear. It's interesting. I don't personally mind having it be depletable in the session. And I guess, I mean, partly I'm thinking about experiences I've had even recently in a campaign session whereby you get one session, the players can fundamentally explore the whole thing. And then next session, you can come back and think about how to use that site. Was there a secret? Yeah.
I think the concerns for a convention game versus a home campaign are different. And I agree with that. Right. That what you're saying, like, I do like that kind of flow you're talking about for a home campaign, but for a convention, a single one shot where we're going to play this and never walk away. And this group is never reforming again as this group again, I want more. And then I don't mind that for transitioning that to campaign play. Again, let's say there were 20 rooms. If there were 20 rooms, I think probably that's more than the players could even. I kind of want to edit that and say 18. Let's say 18 rooms because we had like 12. Okay. So let's add 50% more. Great. Okay. So if there were 18 rooms, I think that would well fill the single 4 hour session. And then I also feel like if you're going to bring that to your home campaign, that's maybe two or three sessions of like, if you assume you're running like, I don't know, 3-ish hour sessions with a group. And that feels good. I like that. Right. I like a dungeon that isn't just one night, right? That they have two, maybe even three, if they want to, you know, if things go badly and they need to retreat and like reevaluate how they're going to approach or something like that, or.
I am finding that the current players in my current sci-fi campaign are happy to be done with a place, and so happy to be done with like a ruiny place. And I think that might just be my current experience right now. If it in that campaign, if it goes on two sessions, I start to get a little bit of static back. And when they've depleted it in one session, they're kind of happy to think about what's the next step of where can they go from there. Let me throw up a question. I think a good question from our friend Ash, and I think I know what they're saying with this. So in the chat, Ash is asking, do you think that this issue about getting to the climax early had more to do with the size of the adventure or with the map layout? And I think what Ash is partly asking there is that there was a clear goal. There was a clear goal that was set up in that adventure. And if the players were really focused on that goal, they could get, they didn't have to go through all 12 rooms. They could get there in maybe half the rooms. Do you think that was part of what we're talking about here?
Possibly. You know, what I want to look at is, because of course I've run some of our other dungeon design dashes as one shots in, okay. It's actually been a thing I've been doing recently, honestly, is right. taking all of our dungeon design dashes and running them at conventions and slowly going through them. So I've run at this point, number one and number two. So one was the Asymmetric Monastery of the Deranged Berserkers. And I'm just looking at that now, and I can tell you that's also a dozen rooms, right? So it's a dozen rooms, but it's a little more, slightly more linear in that, like, the big climactic bad guy is as far away from the entrance as it's possible to be.
Right.
And then I ran number two, which is 10 rooms. And I wish I could put the maps up. I should have thought to put the maps up so I could show folks. So the interesting thing about number two is that how do I describe this shape, Dan? It bifurcates immediately, right? As you enter, you go left or right, and then you can do totally different things, and then both of those paths loop around and rejoin at the, let's say, the main target, the goal area of the plot. So you can go left or you can go right, but either way, that means you can get to the end by going through only about 5 rooms. But there's still half the dungeon you haven't seen, right? Because you chose A instead of B. Whatever.
And of course, we're talking about Crumbling Dungeon of the Ice Bees with this one, right?
Yeah. Folks, if folks have the PDF at home, or if you're looking at the map, you can see that as soon as you enter. And we did this intentionally when we were designing it. The room, honestly, that you would, when you first enter, you go left, right, or you can go down a set of stairs. And if you go down the set of stairs, you end up in the room, in room 10, what we have labeled as room 10, which seems like the big climax, exciting room. And so when we were writing it, we intentionally walled that off, right? We said, like, there's like thick ice here and you can't break through. So you can't get straight to 10 by just walking right through. You have to go left or right through one of these side passages and go through a couple of rooms. I would say in both of those cases, it was in neither of those games that I feel like I was like rushing to wrap things up by the end of the fourth hour. In fact, I felt which is not a bad thing, right? Like, I don't want to be like time pressure to like, oh gosh, try to wrap this up because guys, we're running out of time and everybody's got to leave. But it was much more, I don't know. There was just a lot more space, a lot more time. I think there could have been more. I think in both cases, I felt like there could have been more, which would have been fine. I'm trying to remember now. In the when I ran the first one, I think the group was fairly thorough in exploring it. Now they maybe skipped the little offshoot. They skipped maybe 3 rooms at the beginning that you can just skip.
Right, there's
no reason to go up there. Right. So they did do that. They did skip that. And they pushed forward, and they had some exciting battles, and they got to the end scene, and it got very climactic and crazy and weird. And at that point, I had some players deciding to flee for their lives and others trying to stick it out. And it was a very exciting, great climactic end scene to that adventure.
The words that you just used are very similar to how you could describe your last Fearful Ends game, right? Which was originally a Call of Cthulhu adventure, if I recall correctly. that I played in.
Anyway, I wouldn't mind there being more. But again, I don't know if I want to do that, because if we jump to like 18 rooms now, we're talking about like a 2-hour show, and that's probably too much.
I hear you. Now, I will confess that the issue of do I have a climax timed at the end of the session isn't the biggest thing on my mind personally. And, you know, kudos to Paul for thinking about that. I tend to be, you know, a little bit grittier. Maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know. It's your fault. It's your fault, players. So admittedly, that wasn't one of the priorities that I think about when designing something like that. But as an aside, let me just say, I am so glad, Paul, that you and everybody else is willing to let us reflect and spend some time playtesting, thinking, and refining these things. Because I do feel that in the history of, you know, publications, there's been a lot of stuff where people, you know, pump it out the door as a product and it's fire and forget and it was never playtested. And I really am very, very happy for my personality that we get to come back, we get to play it, we get to talk about how could we improve it. And the way that we've got it up on DriveThruRPG, we can modify it and tweak it if there's something that's obviously an improvement, actually. So I really like the fact that we get to come back in a situation like we're doing right this second and reflect on how we could possibly fine tune one of these things. I think this is actually great for the way that I like to do stuff. So I'm glad we're spending time on that today. Interesting. It is interesting, yeah. But yeah. The 12... You know, the number 12 comes both from experience and back in the first edition era, that was how they set up their tournament modules. Like if you look at the whole Slaver's A series, it was the scoring system is specifically set up for 12 meaty encounters in a linear fashion. You've got to go through them 1 through 12 in order.
Right.
So that's certainly, and that seems to be a pretty good fit for an ambitious, good bunch of players in 4 hours. That's also matched about what my experience has been generally. So it's interesting, if it's non-linear, maybe that breaks down a little bit.
You're probably right. Right. Like when I think about the games that I've run as one shots in the past, I'm trying to think of some of the adventures that I've just lifted from my own campaign and reused as convention games. Usually that's it. Right. There are a lot more rooms, but there's a lot less linearity. I don't know how to say that word. Right. There's right. Many branches you could go down, right? And I'm thinking specifically, yeah. I have an adventure where the players enter and they're entering into a cave in the side of a giant cliff, and they're trying to find a route to the top, to the plateau above. And there are, in fact, three in the dungeon.
Yeah.
And they can go any one of three different directions, or a variety of directions, and ultimately, hopefully, find one of those three outcomes. They might not find any, right? It's plausible that they just wander lost through the dungeon for 4 hours and bumble about and don't get it. But yeah, it gives a lot more variety, which I like, and it gives this impression of like that the space is very big, and that the search is pertinent, right? Like that you don't get in the A series stuff, right? It's so linear. It's just you're going to go through these rooms in order. I don't love that. So I think that's why I want a bigger space, is because I want to allow for that, like that feeling of we are really exploring a space and looking for the end goal, not just like following the obvious progression towards the end goal.
Yeah. You know, I'll just, as an aside, I got to say that because I ran for like our broader group of friends, I ran the whole A series at our house con over about 4 years. And, you know, the fact it's such a fascinating experience, you know, bringing this really old school adventure to players. And I still have to work on the wording I use in the presentation, because I come in and go, look, this is old. This is very old school. It's a tournament module. It is competitive. The goal is to get through these sequence of things, and the players broadly, I'll just say they never got comfortable with the fact that this is a linear progression. They were always still looking for like side route exits, secret doors, something. And it's like they were continually somewhere between bothered and just not believing that it was a tournament, you know, competition obstacle course. And it was so interesting that never became like a natural expectation. It's a side thing with the tournaments. But anyway, let's talk a little bit. Like I thought that it was interesting because it was something that we didn't establish in the design session, which I'll also point out to viewers, we did live on the channel. So you can also from the seminar room in the conference that weekend, the convention. So our viewers can go back and you can actually see the live design that we did. And we never actually established a hook. And I don't, again, that's not something that I feel we need to spoon feed to DMs, frankly. My take is that particularly if you've got an ongoing campaign, that's the easy part. To me, the easy part is why do you want to be here? There's so many different reasons that make sense in your campaign and your game system that the details of the rooms are far more hard to produce, frankly. So we didn't set up a specific hook. And when I came and I sat down on the session that you were actually running, I thought that you had a great hook. Remind me what your pitch was players in that session.
So, and admittedly, I didn't just think this up on the spot at the table, right? Maybe you don't remember this, but after doing the Dungeon Design Dash, at some point during the intervening 48 hours, we went out to dinner with a few folks and we were discussing it a little bit about how it went. And right. I think we had friend of the show, Adam Flynn, at the table. And he was participating in that conversation where I was definitely musing on, well, what is the hook? Because I need to know it. I was like, I'm going to have to say something to the players. Why? What are we doing? Why are we here? Right? Like they need something, not just, there's a dungeon. Good luck.
Which I would do. I mean, I would honestly do that myself. But I, total kudos to everybody who wants more than that.
Yeah. There's definitely a stylistic difference there between the two of us of how we would want to run this. It's a shame, Dan, that you didn't get to also run it because it would be interesting, I think, for us to both have run independently and compare notes. But So what I came up with was that all of the players were under a curse. Not one that really affected them game mechanically, but one that was amusing story-wise that they would be motivated to get rid of. And I described it as simply being that they were under a curse that basically they were constantly perceived in the worst light. Like any social interactions they went on, right, that they were, people just found them unpleasant to be around, right? And I think I kind of had it in my brain that like I would, mechanically you could rule that as like all of their charismas had been tanked or something, right? So you go to the shops and you get just the worst prices ever. If you go out on a date, it just goes terribly, right? Like no one's interested in you, like And so like if you're trying to find work, if you're a mercenary band, you're trying to find work, like they just don't choose your group because you're just so off-putting. And that they had heard rumors that this, the setting I ended up with was, I know we say that it's a, so what's the title of this one, Dan? It's the Crystal something or other of the something or other. Crystal Pyramid, right?
Talks about the Diamond Pyramid of the Elemental Diamond Executioner, Paul. Dungeon Design Dash 6 by Wandering DMs.
Great. The Diamond Pyramid. And so there was a lot of discussion about, well, where is this pyramid, right? Because here, I'm gonna put the map up. We can look at the map while we talk about this, right? That does not look like a pyramid, right? That's right off the cuff. That does not look like a pyramid. And that's fine. And we came up with this whole idea of like, okay, well, the Diamond Pyramid is actually an item that you can find. But there was a lot of discussion about, is there a pyramid? Is this the interior of a pyramid? Is it under a pyramid? Where is this dungeon exactly? What I came up with was a setting of, you're in this old city that in this fantasy world where the city has like risen and collapsed and been invaded and rebuilt and then collapsed again many times. And so the city is full of like old weird structures that some people just don't understand or know what they do because they're just left over from past incarnations of this city. One of which is a huge ziggurat in the center of the city. And the rumors are that in the distant past, in a distant iteration of this city, that there was a cult that operated out of that ziggurat that was known to have healing abilities specifically, and the ability to remove powerful curses. And that possibly that the source of that magic was still underneath the ziggurat somewhere. That was the basic gist. And I think I left some hints about like that it was a unicorn cult, that right, because mm-hmm. there's some unicorn imagery in this dungeon. And that they had quote unquote healing waters, that there were healing waters somewhere within the ziggurat that could remove powerful curses. And we like that. I think in the discussion, one of the nice things about that hook is to be vague about the healing waters, because of course, what I'm actually referring to is the magical healing shower in Area 10. But of course, there's a whole river and a waterfall and a pool. So there's like lots of other options for water that the players could mistake as the healing waters. In fact,
I like that. Waters. Yes, I thought that was great. I think that's a great hook, and part of what I'm jazzed about is that this would be a great drop in a campaign, right? You know, original classic D&D has a lot of cursed stuff, cursed scrolls, cursed swords, cursed, you know, like particularly if you're using supplement one Greyhawk, like half of the magic items are all cursed and you can't get rid of them. So a great drop in of when that happens, if you're low level and you don't have access to remove curse, here's a one evening, you know, one session adventure to go solve that problem. And, you know, more generally, I like the design idiom of if there's some kind of weird gap or something in the rule set that you're playing with, that's an adventure. You get cursed, you find that unfun or a problem or something like that, you got to adventure to fix it. You want knowledge or information, go adventure. You need a regeneration item, that's an adventure. So you don't like the demi-human level limits in classic D&D, you know what, there's an adventure that will remove that for you. So I like all of those things being some kind of in-campaign specific resolution to the player's desires. So I like that a lot. I like the fact that it's a little unclear, like you said, about like what watery thing is do you want here? Now, one thing I noticed observing the play session while you were running it is that there was a bit of an instinct by the players that, well, if the cult is evil, then being purified, being healed or purified by an evil cult is probably actually some bad thing. And there was at least a little bit of cold feet for a little bit. But does it make sense to have an evil cult with something that's actually good for you as a result? How did you feel about that little piece of business?
I don't mind it. You know, the thing is, I don't know, like I've never liked the idea, and you see this in some early adventure design. I never liked the idea where like, oh, if you're an evil cleric, you're going to have the reverse of all the clerical spells. So instead of cure light wounds, you're going to have cause light wounds. But like healing is still useful. That is, being able to heal your allies is useful to anyone, no matter what your motivations are. So, you know, okay, I guess I don't mind the little bit of weird trepidation of like, are we sure about this? Is this going to be okay? You know, I don't know. Not all healing has to be good. Why does it have to be good?
I hear you. And it's also interesting, bringing players into original D&D, there weren't remotely as many reversible things. So, if, you know, in original D&D, you don't have cause light wounds. I think there's only one thing on the cleric list that's reversible, and that's raised dead can become finger of death. And it's a totally unusual thing that they have to have an extra section of the spell text just for that. So it is kind of interesting that players might expect those things to all be distinguished when in original D&D they aren't.
Let me put this forward. I don't recall, and I'm trying to remember because it's unfortunate we're doing this like 2 weeks later, but such is life. I don't recall specifically mentioning that the cult was evil. And I think that's something maybe in the course of the design that I pushed against lightly, because I prefer it to just be there is no good and evil. The cult is the cult. The cult does what the cult wants to do. Okay. It has its own motivations and its own goals. Yeah, sometimes it kills people if that's its motivation to do things. But like, I don't like that extreme binary of every cult must be, you know, goodly aligned or evilly aligned. I don't know. They're just a cult, man. They're doing their thing. So just because I use the word cult, what if I called them a a club? What if they were a club, Dan, or an organization, a union, if you will?
So I do swing in a slightly different direction on that, and that was a little bit of the tension in the design. I support. I'm not surprised, but when you call it a cult, that people are going to have a bad reaction to it. I tend to swing for the fences in the direction of like vileness that you need to confront.
I prefer to live in the gray, I guess is what I'm getting at. I prefer to live in that gray area. I like that cult is not like a happy fun. Okay. They're you know, maybe not, you know, the upstanding bastions of law and order if you're going to call them a cult. But also they're not necessarily like, you know, aligned with demons and trying to overtake the world. They're, you know, they're just trying to push forward their own objectives.
I don't mind planting a flag in my fantasy that human sacrifice is a bad thing. So I'm willing to paint with a fairly broad brush.
So you assume that all enemies that the elemental executioner killed are human?
I did.
And that they're good people?
Well, I mean, I'm going to say human sacrifice isn't great either way. I mean, I guess I don't normally use the word executioner for non-human.
I like too that you're using the word sacrifice, which isn't in here. He's an executioner. He's not a sacrificial god, right?
Okay.
He's
not, all right.
Right. It's an executioner, right? Like, I don't know. You know, when the French brought the nobles up to the guillotine, was that good or evil, Dan?
Pretty fine. You know what? I've been saying some positive things about that recently as I've been thinking about historical events, frankly. So great art. Once again, fantastic argument. I'm so impressed. I'm going to have to think about that. So the text does say victims. I mean, they say the cultists threw their victims to be executed.
I think that's fair. There's no indication in the text though about whether those victims were innocent or not. Were they tried? Was there a trial before the execution? Maybe.
Well, I mean, those would be like, I don't know.
in fact, I kind of want to go back now, and I want to now rework Room 9. This is great. This is such good stuff. Okay, Room 9. Let's talk about Room 9.
Yeah, okay.
For anybody who watched it, right? Room 9 is this weird, there's like this raised area, and then there's a lower area, and there's a bunch of zombies like of the original cult milling about, still doing their old duties. And there's shelves lining the walls with skulls in them that all have been etched with an symbol of the cult. Okay? I'm now tempted to redress this a little bit to make like the raised area like a court, like the bench of a court, right? Maybe the rituals that the zombies are performing ad infinitum are essentially a trial. Maybe.
I you know what? That's actually a nice twist. That this is totally not the direction I was going,
business,
but actually,
right?
I got to admit, I don't mind. That's actually a pretty nice twist, actually.
I don't hate that. And the only thing I don't like about that then is that the bridge comes before the courtroom. Now I have to like revamp that, like possibly when the cult was using it, the real answer is you would go north to 3 and you come across the bridge to 4, you go to 9 for your trial, and then if you're found guilty, you're brought back to 5 for your execution. I gotta like maybe rethink what the hell's going on in area 2. Now I'm rewriting the whole adventure. Now let me knock it off.
Yes. You know what? And I find that to be a little bit of a risk on my end too, in different directions. I don't know. Maybe we need to support that. We need to support the DM rewriting whatever they want on the fly.
It's interesting. You know, you and I were talking about just the reception of some of these dungeon design dashes that we've put up there. Geez. And when we first started this, our goal was to write them in one page dungeon format, and they've gotten a little longer, right? They've eked out to like 2 and 3 pages now. But I've always pushed for that very brief, very concise text, because I love that. Yeah. Both from just like an ease of running the game, and because of all the white space it creates for me to improvise at the table. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that as a DM, and I want that. And so that's what I like to produce here, right? I like areas that are vague enough that I can make this stuff up as we go if I wanted to.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's funny because I have never been 100% convinced by the one page format. I've never been married to it or completely convinced by it, but I 100% agree that I do like the short text. I like the me or anybody else being able to scan it very briefly on the fly, get the essential elements, and then improvise everything else around that. So I think early on I was very comfortable saying, yeah, if we go to 2 pages, if we go to 3 pages, fine. We're not going to be making this 20 pages. We're not going to be making a single encounter area that runs for a page and a half, which was a TSR product style at one point. I totally agree with the extent that we've got it right now.
I will say I've gotten uneasy on some of the ones that we've done, like the Pumpkin King I'm thinking of specifically, where there are some numbered areas that get on to like maybe 3 paragraphs of text. And I'm starting to think, that's maybe too much text for a one number. And in this case, I think it was fine, right? I'm not like really sweating it, but like that is definitely getting to the level of this is more text than I want.
I think that there was a number of things that were trappy to us with the outdoors situation. And I think I've said that before, is when you are outdoors, there's a lot of extra you could, you know, is this a village? Is it a city? Working off the rather abstract map by Dice and Logos. And I think that trying to kind of fill that in a bit was what caused us to go in that direction. So there's, once again, the lesson is there's a lot of advantages to the constraints that the dungeon format gives you. That's actually one of them.
We've run the clock here a bit. Do you want to talk more about what actually happened in the actual playtest?
I had a major thing I was gonna say. What the heck? I wanted to talk about when people look at our dungeon design dashes, the first page is map, background, wandering monsters. And a lot of people historically have said, wandering monsters, that's not story. That's like, where's the story of some random, that wasn't, how do I know what the plot is? Why are wandering monsters there? Why are there dead ends in the dungeon? That's not the story. But we always have that as kind of a highlighted element. That's part, you know, us designing the wandering monster chart is part of our mental mapping out like what's in here fundamentally. And boy, I thought that was one of the best elements that happened in your game when there was a wandering monster that showed up. And I'll also point out that it's not something I do, but you, we're both now checking for wandering monsters on real-time clocks. And what you did is you had the players make the roll. So I always do it, you know, I describe it and do it in public with me rolling a big die. You actually have the players make the roll, and then that actually came up positive, and really fascinating stuff happened as a result. Tell us what that was.
Yeah. So, and admittedly, this was a bit of an experiment for me, and I vary on how much I use the Wandering Monster chart. I will say that.
Okay. Sure.
And I'm thinking back to having run some of the other Wandering DMs, Dungeon Design Dashes as convention games. you know, I tend to be, when it's solely behind the screen, I tend to be a little more wishy-washy about it. And I'm like, well, you know, if the party is going slow and it would add to the tension of the game, I'm going to make a roll. But I've never been regimented about it. And there've been plenty of games where I've just never rolled it at all. In this game, I thought it would be interesting to try that like real wall clock time rolling. And I thought it would add a little bit of tension, a little bit of time pressure of like, well, we better get going and find the thing. Otherwise, something's going to come along and cause us trouble. And I think I did skip it once. I think there was one indication where like the wandering monster clock kind of came around just as we were finishing up a previous encounter. And I was like, it's fine. Like we do not need it. That's just going to feel tedious at this point. So let's skip it. But I did have, I had a clock out and I was watching it and whatnot. And I think just through luck, we got a great encounter out of it. I'll pull the map back up so I can describe exactly what happened here. So the players had just finished exploring Area 2 and were moving on to the bridge of Area 5. And in Area 5, there's this bridge, goes over the waters. There's a little staircase to the right just as you're approaching the bridge. The steep, rocky, wet staircase at the bottom of which there is a corpse lying on the ground, which will animate as a zombie if you go and deal with it. And of course, the elemental executioner is a water elemental that lives in this river, right? We know that, right? That is allegedly the victims correctly adjudicated guilty are pushed from the bridge to be consumed by the water elemental below. That is their method of execution. So anyway, the players get up there onto Area 5, and I roll the wandering monster chart, and it comes up that there's a wandering monster. And the result of the wandering monster was a white. And so I decided to have him appear on the other side of the bridge, right? Kind of emerging from maybe from 7 or 9 or something like that, kind of appearing at the end of the bridge, you know, ready to menace the players. Two of the players rushed the white, one of them triggering the trapdoor in the bridge and falling into the water. The second one, likewise, tripping and falling into the water. So now I've got two players getting swept down the river. And then I have a third player who decides, well, I'm not going to make the same stupid mistake. And they run down the stairs and trigger the zombie. So now we've got the water elemental in the water, the white up on the bridge, and the zombie down the stairs, making this like crazy multi-enemy encounter that is moving across multiple locations, right? We've got some players in Area 5 and some down in Area, 8, I think, on the beach. And it turned into utter chaos and was really quite fun, right? There was a lot of dramatic excitement going on at that point.
Agreed. And it was funny, and I'll say that particular moment was funny for me because I'd come in and I was just observing and making some notes, frankly, these notes, from a table next door. And I had my game bag with me, and you stepped over. And once it got sufficiently sophisticated, you know, complicated, I think Paul and I both come into these games not expecting to normally use a battle map and miniatures, but we have it as a backup if we need to. And this went so sideways in every direction that Paul steps over and says, "Dan, can I borrow a battle map?" And I go, "You got it." And I just, "Hey, yep, I got that with me. Here's that. Here's some markers. You got that." He goes, "Do you have figures?" I go, "Yep. Here's figures for all the characters that you have." Okay. And he goes, "Boy, it's just too bad that you don't at this point that you don't have a miniature for a water elemental. Would be great." I go, "I got you covered, buddy." And I hand Paul a water elemental in miniature that I just happen to have. Yeah. So that was kind of funny. And you totally needed it. It was so wild. At that moment, it was, that you totally needed it, and it was the wandering monster that triggered it.
And and I do like that. I like it a lot when adventures, you know, produce those kinds of encounters like that move around the map, that aren't just static in a room, right?
Yes.
And granted, we had several other encounters that were static in a room, and I did not pull out the miniatures. It was not necessary. I didn't think right. They fought some zombies in 9. They, you know, other stuff. But it's why you want things like Area 4. And I think we discussed this during the creation, right? Area 4 is a narrow, slippery bridge high up over the water.
Yeah.
And that's it. There's nothing of interest there otherwise. But it is interesting if you're running for your life from Area 3 to 9 or vice versa.
Exactly.
Something's chasing you. And now there's a slippery bridge that might exactly. cause problems. Yeah.
Yeah. And the hope, and I will just, as an aside, I'll say similarly, you know, old school dungeons frequently have these dead ends, and they're interesting in that exact same situation. I've had some of the most memorable nail biting situations in the past of players are running for their lives. They take one branch. It happens to be a dead end, and I'm rolling a random die to see which way the monsters go. Do they follow you into the dead end, or do they miss you and go a different way? Or you know, usually if I have players in a dead end, I'm like, this is a good time for a wandering monster check. Are you blocked in by a wandering monster? And those are all legitimate, you know, interesting, dramatic, strategic moments. And I thought that was a really interesting highlight, that it was specifically the wandering monster that triggered all that action, really made it interesting that we couldn't have predicted in advance.
I do like wandering monsters. I like what they bring to the table. I've definitely struggled with figuring out exactly when, how, and where to roll them. There was a time back in the day when I was exploring, when I was playing a lot of BX, where I actually just had a turn counter, you know, like a highly visible little turn counter that I could flip. This is the turn number. And I was doing much more very specific, like, it takes you this many turns to walk down this hallway, flip, 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 right?
And then, which is the rules as written. That's absolutely the actual text rule in all the classic D&D sets.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I've done more just fiat of just like, well, when it's interesting, I'm going to roll a wandering monster chart, like when the players are dickering around and not doing anything, you know, or causing delays or making noise, right? Like cases where I'm like, well, contextually, if there was a monster nearby,
yes,
they might hear you, right? So, and I don't mind that, but it always feels a little loose and wobbly to me. So I liked the idea of like tying it to a wall clock, but also feeling empowered as a DM to just say, you know what, not this time. I'm just not going to roll it.
You know, it's funny because I'm sure I'm not the only person to have come up with the clock time, but I didn't hear it anywhere else. So if anything, it's parallel development. And I just saw recently Mike Merle's writing that he just thought of starting to try that out in his own games, and I was able to give him a little bit of experience that I've done that for years myself. I got to admit, as I've said before, I don't trust on the issue of wait for dramatic moments. Like as DM, I don't trust myself that my sense of a dramatic moment is the same as the players, or that my sense of getting bored is the same as the players. So for that reason, you know, I don't mind like you're making a lot of noise. That makes sense in world. You're spending a lot of time searching for secret doors. That can make sense in world. But my personal opinion is that I veer away from, you know, sense of drama, because I might not be being fair to the players, frankly. So the wall clock has worked pretty well for many of us.
Wall clock is nice. I think I was doing every half hour I was rolling, right? And I was, and I think it was maybe a one on a D6 or a one and two. I can't even remember which I was doing. And then also, I guess, in addition to like wanting, you know, I definitely want the ability to just fiat it away simply because like just, the, you know, dramatic and action based, right? Like, especially in one case, like, well, we just had a fight and it just took us half an hour to resolve. And now we're just going to immediately roll another die. I can feel like it's already starting to feel grindy to me. And I don't want that in my game. On the other hand, I also want the ability to accelerate the clock. If the party's like, well, we found this nice defensible spot, we're going to hole up and rest here for the next 8 hours.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to roll a lot of wandering monster checks then, frankly.
I hear you. Yep. Reasonable. I tend to embrace the grind a little bit more, but absolutely reasonable. And I'm certainly not going to argue that I've hit every single encounter die every 15 minutes. But I tend to wave them a little bit less. Before we run out of time, Paul, I want to say two things that I think are a little bit amusing. Number one is, we've been talking about your playtest at RPGCon, and I had a playtest the prior day on the schedule that I didn't get an opportunity to run. The original plan was that we'd design DD6 on Friday, I would run it on Saturday, and you'd run it on Sunday. And we had it. I had mine on the schedule. I didn't get to run it for a rather amusing reason. That is that I scheduled it late night. And as some people know, I'm a little bit of a late owl, a little bit of a night owl. And so the convention accepted, the convention scheduler accepted my proposal. It was one of the supported time slots that was advertised. The people running the convention accepted it. So I actually scheduled mine late night, Saturday night from 11 p.m. to 3 a.m. And I thought this is great. If people are looking for something to do, this is great. And it was on the schedule, and then it turned out to run up against, and RPG Con is just in its fourth year, so you know we're all still finding stuff out. So it ran up against the fact that the venue closed all the rooms at 11:30. So I actually went in because I had another session, another thing I was doing Friday night, setting up at 11. And then the staffer comes over and goes, this room's closed. We're going to lock this room up at 11:30 p.m. You can't run a game here. So I think that was a learning experience for me, that even though it's on the schedule, apparently no one's ever scheduled actually a late night thing at RPG Con to date until I did it. And it actually didn't work at this time. So probably in the future, that's a lesson for me, that might be an issue. Hopefully that's a learning issue for the organizers of RPG Con that they didn't foresee. And that's the reason why we only have one playtest instead of two with my take at it.
The impression I got from the staff was that they did want to support late night games if people wanted to play them. And there was just a miscommunication there between the people trying to set the rules and the people implementing them. But that said, you know, you do have to account for, like, just because the convention lets you do it doesn't mean that there's demand, right? Like, are there enough players who are like up that late who want to play that particular kind of game at that time at night, right? And this is something I always recommend. It's something I do for myself, and I would recommend for anybody when attending a new convention.
Yeah,
is don't schedule stuff for the first time you go to a brand new convention. Just go, just get the vibe, just show up, see what you can fall into. Don't gnash your teeth over trying to schedule stuff for yourself, because you don't know what the vibe is there, right? You don't know what the demand is going to be like. You don't know what people like. Like, I think it's worth getting going once just to you know, figure it out. And of course, we totally didn't get to do this. The first year Dan got to go to this convention, and I was immediately like, all right, into the fire. Here we go. We're going to run this crazy.
We were being aggressive. I don't mind that. And it was in the spirit of, we're doing a live design thing that has never been done here or anywhere, frankly. So I felt like the whole, we set up the whole weekend to be a fun, exciting experiment that we were being a little bit aggressive with. So I don't mind, again, I don't mind the failure being how those lessons will be memorable to me personally. The other thing I wanted to point out before we wrap up is that we're still working behind the scenes on the published version of what we're talking about here, Dungeon Design Dash number 6. But Dungeon Design Dashes 1 through 5 are currently available on DriveThruRPG. All of our patrons have had free access to those. So if you want to see them, you could either become a patron at the $1 level, or you could go to DriveThruRPG and pitch $1 at it. And some of our patrons on Discord fairly recently pointed out that there was a nice review of the last one, Dungeon Design Dash number 5, which was Infested Perch of the Mammoth Egg, and a review. And thanks to Bryce at 10footpole.org for reading, considering, putting up the review. And you might go look for that review of DDD5 at 10footpole.org, where Bryce said things like, these are all generally pretty good. Overall, not bad.
High praise.
Ben, we've been thinking about what Bryce wrote there, and you know, we appreciate thinking about our work and the feedback, and that might very well modify how we're going to present some stuff in the future. Actually,
yeah, there was some nice notes from him on some formatting stuff that would be easy to change. So we're definitely contemplating some of those changes. Now, just to be clear, folks, for anybody joining currently in the Patreon or joining the Patreon, generally our process is after we run a Dungeon Design Dash and we finish up the PDF and make it available, we throw it onto the Patreon for a month for free. So anyone who's on the Patreon during that course of that month has it available. I think that right now, if you join right now, I think the earlier ones have already expired out. So you'll be in the join the Patreon and you'll get access to the sixth one when it comes out, which should be very soon. But I think the older ones you'll have to go find on DriveThru.
Good note. Yep. There, you know, I enjoy doing them. I look forward to doing to cleaning up DDD6 and then doing more in the future. If people have, you know, we're looking for other conventions to iterate on our process as a piece of entertainment, actually, for us performing with, you know, audience participation. So if people have ideas for other conventions that this would be great at, we would love to hear a pitch, actually, about where else we should take this.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we'll definitely do more Dungeon Design Dashes here on the show, because I think we mm-hmm, both agree mm-hmm. It's very enjoyable for us. But yeah. I'm very curious about more of it as a live performance. So I'd love to do that more. Well, I'm sure we'll do it again next year at Rising Phoenix Game Con. And maybe some other local conventions. And if anybody's got a particular one that you think that would be great to see us at, please let us know.
Yeah, awesome.
Dan, we are out of time. Any final thoughts on Dungeon Design Dash number 6?
Well, like I say, I like getting to refine this, and I like taking, whether it's at, you know, old school publications and rerunning them and thinking about it. I actually really like refining a particular script, so to speak, and seeing what the play experience is and how we could possibly make it better for that adventure or other ones in the future. So I'm really glad that I want to do more play tests, frankly, of all of our design dashes. And I'm glad we got to do this one, and thanks to you, Paul, and everybody for having the opportunity to think about it publicly, about how that went and what we could do better in the future. So I think that's a great little adventure. I like what we did with that, and I'm looking forward to playing the other ones as well.
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, I've personally been trying to go through and run all of them because I just haven't gotten the chance to do it yet. Now I've run 1, 2, and 6 at this point. And I guess technically 5, right? We've definitely run, not 5, sorry, 4, the Pumpkin King one. Yeah. I've run the Pumpkin King one. So I guess 3
Mega and...
yeah. And in fact, I ran it once using Fearful Ends separately. So I've run that one twice.
You're right. Which is fantastic.
Yeah, so I will definitely be looking for an opportunity to run WDM03, the Desolate Sanctum of the Flying Lich. That one should be fun. Yeah, higher level one. That should be should be interesting. And then, of course, number 5, the Infested Perch of the Mammoth Egg. So look for a chance to run that one, I think.
Nice.
And I'm looking forward to running to putting another one up, right? So let's get number 6 out the door for all of our patrons, so that you guys can check it out. I think it's a good one. I think it's a fun one. I think maybe I'm starting to come around to the idea that maybe really the pacing problem in this one is simply how easy it is to get to the main boss just quickly through like 3 rooms. That is interesting. Though I'm not sure I would want to force players to not do that. So I don't know. I'm still a little wobbly on that to be, what I want out of that.
I don't see that as a big problem myself, but I'm not trying to
You and I will just have to disagree on that point.
Yep, we will. We'll fight it out. We'll fight it out in game hall.
Viewers, if you've run any of the design dashes and have some experiences to share, I'd love to hear from you. Please leave a comment in the YouTube chat section. Tell us how it went, what you liked, what you didn't like, or go review us on DriveThru RPG. There's a review section there. Tell us what you think of the adventure. Like Dan said, we love to iterate on these. We may update old Dungeon Design Dashes, or we may just take that as input to the future ones. So please do let us know what you think.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there and updates on upcoming shows. And please give a good shakedown to that like button while you're there.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com and also through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, a bunch of them. Anyway, if you're listening to the show right now on one of those third-party carriers and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
You know, we really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And you'll see that every single one of our tiers gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation is round the clock about old school D&D and new school and science fiction, miniatures, and all kinds of great stuff like that. All the stuff that we love. We would love to see you there. And also, like Paul said, at the top of the hour, we will be there for our live video after chat on Discord in about 10 minutes after the show here. And we'll get more of your ideas about things that we missed here in this hour, about things you want to see or things we could possibly improve in our dungeon design dashes or maybe how we run them. Other thing, Paul, next week, so that's going to be May 25th, I believe. Next Sunday, we're planning on having one of our favorite guests here, Mr. Matt Finch, return to talk about his new version of Osric that's coming out, which is, of course, the original retro clone of first edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. So Matt's taken some time here to brush up and improve the Osric rules, which many, many people use to run classic D&D adventures. And we may have had a tiny bit of input into those revised Osric rules that may possibly come up next Sunday. So we'll hope that everybody joins us next week. Get your questions into Matt about the new version of Osric. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, me too. Always enjoy having Matt on the show, so I'm excited to talk to him.
Definitely, same here. So don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, and we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.